This is the Stress in the City podcast, a self-care book review show for the busy and, quite frankly, burned out. I'm your host, Brittany Nicole, and each episode I'll break down the best books in self-care to help us all figure out how to do this life thing better. Ready? Let's start the show. Welcome, welcome, welcome back to another episode of the Stress and the City podcast. I am your host, Brittany Nicole. I thank you so much for joining me. I also want to say thank you to everybody who gave me really good feedback on my very first episode. I am a baby podcaster, so you know, all the kind words and encouragement just really means a lot to me as I go on this venture. So thank you to you all. Last episode was just kind of an introduction to who I am and what my intentions are for this podcast. But this week, I actually want to get into the meat. And I'm kind of starting off with a bang here. This is a book that I have read 3 times now over the last couple of years. I recently reread it at the behest of my therapists, plural. And I think it's an important book for every woman to read. Even men, I think it's kind of important to read because it talks about women's sexuality and sexual well-being in a way that, you know, it's a book about sex. So yeah, we're talking about genitals. We're talking about clitorises. We're saying the word sex a lot. And if you're in a place where you can't really, you know, you don't really want those words to be heard by others, children maybe, this is your little warning, like earphones might be a good idea, or listening another time might be a good idea, or if you're just uncomfortable with those topics, then this might not be the episode for you, but maybe it is. But the thing that I appreciate about this book is that it's very fact-based. It's very educational. It's very informational. And I've learned a lot. And each time I've revisited it, I have learned something different. So that's why I'm starting off with this one. The name of the book is called Come As You Are. It's by Emily Nagoski, which she is a sex researcher and an expert in women's sexuality and well-being. So the author of the book, Emily Nagoski, she kind of talks about why she wrote the book. And she says, basically, in her experience as a sex researcher, she gets a lot of, you know, a lot of people asking her questions that they feel uncomfortable to ask their friends or uncomfortable to ask themselves. And what belies those questions tends to be some version of, am I normal, you know? And this is kind of a vulnerable topic. It's, you know, your body and your sexuality is not something that, you know, you just put on Instagram every day. Well, maybe some people do, but it's kind of a, it can be an uncomfortable thing to talk about and to have questions about. And I think this book answers a lot of questions that probably a lot of people have, or maybe have answers to questions that they don't even know that they have. So let's get right into it. So this to me is, I think, one of the biggest takeaways from this book. There are these researchers named Eric Jansen and John Bancroft, and they developed this model which describes human sexual response, and it helps us to kind of understand and organize, you know, the way sexuality happens for humans better. And it's called the dual control model. So basically what the dual control model is a mechanism of a sexual accelerator and a brake. And so the accelerator and the brake, they respond to different stimuli, whether that's visual stimulation, emotional context, you know, physical sensations. They can either step on the gas or they can step on the brakes for us. And although she doesn't agree that there is a such thing as a sex drive, which she goes into later on in the book. And I can understand, you know, her reasoning on that. I think the visual understanding of sex as a drive with a gas pedal and a brake really kind of helps to break down what's happening, especially if what you're trying to do is troubleshoot issues. You know, basically, if the accelerator are things that turn you on and the brakes are things that turn you off, and you can even hit both at the same time. So depending on what your situation is, the question is, you know, do I need more accelerator? Do I need more turn on? Do I need less brake to, you know, turning off more of the turn offs? Like what's the situation? So I think the dual control model concept is really helpful in understanding human sexuality. And it's also interesting to note that it's not even a metaphor. You know, if it actually, there's a diagram in the book that talks about the different areas of the brain that these mechanisms respond to. So yeah, it's an easy way of understanding a concept, but it's actually something that's happening biologically in our mind and in our body. And I think that's a really key point. That was a really, really key takeaway for me. Another great takeaway, anatomy. This is the first book that I've ever seen, and maybe there are others, but this is the first book that I've seen that goes into like extreme detail about female anatomy. And I really appreciated not only just the way that the differences were explained, but the way that the similarities were explained as well. I had never heard of homologue, which it means they're traits that have the same biological origins, even though they may have different functions. So for example, the female equivalent to the male penis is the clitoris. And I don't think I heard it in this book. I'll have to go back and check, but I don't think so. I can't remember exactly where I read it, but the female genitalia has almost the same amount of erectile tissue as the penis, which I think is so interesting. Another interesting part of the anatomy is all the different facts about the clitoris that she goes into. I found it interesting that even though it's much smaller than the penis, typically 1/8 the size, it has double the nerve endings. And while the penis has 4 functions, the clitoris has only one job, and that is sensation. Also, the external part of the clitoris that you can see outside of the body, that's just a head. I saw a really interesting picture on Instagram. I'll have to link that in the show notes, which shows, it's a diagram of the whole structure of the clitoris, but what it looks like in a non-aroused state and then what it looks like in an aroused state. And, you know, we're familiar with the male erection, obviously, like we know what that looks like, but I don't think I've ever seen any type of diagram of what like a truly aroused clitoris looks like, because it's an internal structure. So I thought that was interesting. Also, and this part, when I think about it, it kind of pisses me off a little bit for not being taught this, that, you know, we often say vagina when we're talking about female genitalia, but that really only refers to the internal canal, the part that leads to the uterus. When we talk about everything, the whole package, vulva is actually the correct term. And, you know, who doesn't have sex ed in school? I did. But we never talked about a vulva. We didn't even talk about the clitoris. The only thing for girls that we talked about was periods. And even the conversation around periods was very limited. I didn't learn about different, you know, I didn't even know that there were different phases of our menstrual cycle until I was grown and married. But, you know, what can you say? Public education. That's probably another podcast episode. Moving right along. So I loved this metaphor that she talks about throughout the book, and it's our sexuality as a garden. I don't think I'm going to be able to sum this up as well as she did, this part. She threads throughout the book this metaphor of a garden, and I'm actually just going to read what I really liked about this story, and then I'll go into why I love it so much. So goes like this. On the day you're born, you're given a little plot of rich and fertile soil, slightly different from everyone else's. And right away, your family and culture start to plant things and tend the garden for you until you're old enough to take over its care yourself. They plant language and attitudes and knowledge about love and safety and bodies and pleasure. And they teach you how to tend your garden, because as you transition through adolescence into adulthood, you'll take on full responsibility for its care. And you didn't choose any of that. You didn't choose your plot of land, the seeds that were planted, or the way your garden was tended in the early years of your life. As you reach adolescence, you begin to take care of the garden on your own. And you may find that your family and culture have planted some beautiful, healthy things that are thriving in a well-tended garden. And you may notice some things you want to change. Maybe the strategies you were taught for cultivating the garden are inefficient, so you need to find different ways of taking care of it so that it will thrive. Maybe the seeds that were planted were not the kind of thing that will thrive in your particular garden, so you need to find something that's a better fit for you. Some of us get lucky with our land and what gets planted. We have healthy, thriving gardens from the earliest moments of our awareness. And some of us get stuck with some pretty toxic crap in our gardens, and we're left with the task of uprooting all the junk and replacing it with something healthier, something we choose for ourselves. I love that story. I love that concept. And it's something that I've really taken with me. I remember when I first read that years ago, I must have been listening to it as an audiobook, because I was in the car. I was pulling into the garage that led to my apartment, and I didn't get out the car for a while. I just sat there. I sat there and thought about, like, my garden and what was in it and how much negativity and doubt and shame was there. And I, like, sat there for a while and thought about, like, who planted that there? Like, who put these thoughts in my head about what I'm not and that I'm broken? Because I didn't come to this planet with that. And I actually, I figured out, if for me, it was my grandfather. I didn't really have any thoughts about the body or the way I looked until I was about 10 years old. And that's when he started telling me that I was fat and making fun of me and, you know, encouraging other family members to make fun of me. And he just seemed to enjoy it. It was awful for me. It was really awful. And, you know, I remember, like, that's when I first started experimenting with dieting and, like, watching workout videos. At 10 years old, I'm drinking Slim Fast because I feel like I need to lose weight. And I think it was a really, really awful thing for him to plant. And that's when I learned to be ashamed of myself. And it honestly took me probably 15 years later to realize what was planted there and to decide, I don't agree with that. I don't agree with what you put there, and I'm taking that out. And then the other part that I like about the garden metaphor is, because when I think of self-care, even beyond sexuality, this is the metaphor that I use for myself. My body is my garden. And I like to remember that when I get impatient with myself, when I'm like, man, I'm working so hard, I'm eating so clean, I want these results and I want them now. But, you know, just like a garden, like, you don't just plant some, you know, herbs and then be able to make a cocktail the next day with the mint you wanted. Like, you have to wait. These things take time. And even if you want to weed things out of your garden, you have to do it gently so you don't hurt everything. And then, you know, this is probably a side note and probably a whole different episode, but learning so much about the gut and the microbiome this year, that really like is our literal internal garden. But I won't go there now. That's another book and another time. But I just really love that garden metaphor, and I take it with me in the way that I treat myself and the way that I think about what I put in my mind and what I put in my body. So I want to talk next about our most powerful sex organ, which is the brain. At this part of the book, she actually goes into more depth about like how the accelerator and the brake works, and basically goes something like this. So we have two systems. We have the sexual excitation system. This is the accelerator. And what this system does is it uses your senses to scan your environment for anything sex-related, any sex-related information, and it sends signals from your brain to your genitals and says, turn on. It's kind of like a motion sensor light. Like if you have floodlights outside your house, it is activated by, you know, it senses movement in the area. And if something moves, the light turns on. That's what your excitation system is like. And it works below our level of consciousness. So basically what that means is your brain is always scanning for sexual information. And if it's the good kind of sexual information, or the kind that your brain interprets as good, then you interpret that as you as a person interpret that as a turn on. Then there's the sexual inhibition system. And these are the brakes. There's two brakes, which I'm not really too super sure on the difference between them. That she describes one as a foot brake and a hand brake. And I didn't really understand the hand brake part as much. Like the foot brake, she said, was similar to the excitation system in that it also uses your senses to scan your environment, but instead of looking for sexual information to turn you on, it's looking for threats or anything that your brain might interpret as like, no, don't turn on. Like, we don't have time for that right now. And it could be, you know, something basic, like we're in a Zoom meeting right now. Like, we don't have time to be thinking about that. No, turn that off, shut that down. Or it could be something abrupt, like you're in the middle of some action and your kid walks in the room. So that's the inhibition system. And this is the part where you can see a diagram of the different areas of the brain that's associated with each process. She also talks about sexual temperament. So, you know, we have the accelerator and we have the brakes, but then what varies from person to person is how sensitive is the accelerator and how sensitive is the brake. And what's kind of cool is she has actually an assessment in the book that asks questions to gauge how low or high your sensitivity is on both of those mechanisms. According to her studies, most people fall in the normal category, but 2 to 6% of women have a sensitive accelerator and not a sensitive brake. Basically, what that means is this category of women, it's very easy for them to turn on, and they don't evaluate, they don't perceive many things to be a threat. And this combination is associated with risk-taking and compulsivity. And there's 1 to 4% of women have sensitive brakes and not a sensitive accelerator. So that means, you know, their brain is always scanning for threats and perceives a lot of threats, and the accelerator is very difficult to turn on. And so this group is associated with difficulty with getting aroused, or lack of interest, lack of desire, difficulty with orgasm. And then outside of those groups, everybody else would fall in some degree of normal. If you're curious where you fall on the scale, there actually is an assessment included with the book. She does specify, like, don't use this as a diagnostic tool, but it does kind of give you an idea of where you fall. And I definitely would recommend taking the assessment for yourself, for sure. Okay, let's talk about what turns you on. So this sounds so basic when you say it. When you say it, it's like, well, duh. She describes sexual arousal as the dual process of turning on the ons and turning off the offs. Duh, right? Like, of course. But I think that we tend to focus culturally on the ons and not enough on turning off the offs. Like, what I mean is, you know, you can add all the lingerie, ambiance, role play, whatever you want in the world, that's accelerator. But if you suspect your partner's cheating on you, your brakes are on. You're still not going anywhere, no matter how hard you press on the accelerator. Or you could be in a great relationship and, you know, love your partner and be attracted to your partner. That's accelerator right there. But if you're dealing with shame about your body, and you don't feel comfortable in your body, you don't want your partner to see your body, you have doubts about your body, that's your brakes on. So it's also going to be difficult for you to go anywhere. And I think, you know, we think a lot about turn on in our society, and we don't think enough about, like, what do we do about our turn offs? And I think that's the work. And I think a lot of our work as women especially is figuring out both our turn-ons and our turn-offs and navigating them, changing them if we feel compelled to, working through whatever deeper internal issues that we have. But we also need to be given the space within our intimate relationships to do that and for those things to be, for our turn-ons and our turn-offs to be respected and valued and understood. Like, a sexual relationship is a co-creative process, you know? She gave something which I think is a good, kind of a good starting point for that whole figuring out the turn-ons and turn-offs process. There's two researchers, Katie McCall and Cindy Weston. I don't know if this was a study or if it was a focus group, but they came up with different categories for cues for sexual desire factors, basically categories of turn-ons is how I understood it. So one category is love and emotional bonding. That is like feeling secure in your relationship, feeling a sense of commitment and emotional closeness, feeling supported, feeling protected. That can be a turn-on, that can step on the accelerator for you in your relationship. Another category is explicit or erotic cues. These are things that are specifically about sex, whether it's watching a sexy movie or a romantic movie, reading a story, watching or hearing other people being intimate, anticipating being intimate with your partner, knowing that your partner desires you. Those are explicit or erotic cues. It's also visual and proximity cues, which is, you know, being attracted to someone, seeing someone that you feel is attracted and well-dressed and you like the way their body looks and they are very confident and they give off an energy that just intoxicates you. That's visual and proximity clues. Romantic or implicit clues is another category. And these are things that we typically associate with romance, dancing closely, massages, going on dates, intimate touch, smelling good. I'm sure there, you know, this is not a exhaustive list of every possible turn on there is, but I think it's a good starting place to have a category. And maybe as an exercise for yourself, you know, start with one category and see how many things you can come up with under that category. They don't even necessarily have to be things that turn you on. It just, I think, is a good creative exercise for you to start thinking about what could turn you on. Never know what you might come across. I wish that this same category was created for turnoffs. And it wasn't exactly, there was kind of something. There was a focus group for turnoffs by four different researchers. And I remember a couple of the things on there that people had described as turnoffs for themselves were, you know, feeling uncomfortable in their own body, unwanted pregnancy, being concerned about, you know, their reputation or how they're going to be perceived, not feeling accepted by their partner or feeling judged by their partner was considered a turn off, being in a negative mood or depressed, anxious, that kind of thing. And then also the way that they were approached or the style that they were approached. Those are some of the things that people in this focus group had described as a turn off. Same thing. It's not an exhaustive list, but just I think just as important, maybe if not more, is to think about, like, what are things that turn me off? And you can kind of also tell from the list of turnoffs in that focus group that a lot of them didn't really have much to do with sex at all. So I think, you know, when we're conceptualizing, like, what are things that turn me off? Maybe a better question is, like, what are things that stress me out? You know, what are things that make it difficult for me to want to be intimate? What are barriers to intimacy for me? You know, it may not be directly about sex at all. I also like the point when she about turn on and turn offs, like I'm saying now, that this isn't an exhaustive list. And also, you know, it's kind of complicated, because even somebody who, like, let's say you got all the turn ons going on, they feel good about themselves, they feel good about their relationship. If they got COVID, ain't nobody thinking about sex right now. Like, or, you know, let's say everything's Gucci. You feel great about yourself. You feel great about your relationship, but your partner just blew up the bathroom. Yeah, like, no. I'm gonna need you to cool off a little bit first. So it depends on context. And I would say dual control model for me is the number one takeaway. And context, I think, is number two. So let's go right into that. Context. What is context? Context is made up of two things. It's the circumstances of the present moment. So where you are, who you're with, what kind of environment are you in? Do you like that environment? Is it a new environment? Is it a familiar environment, et cetera? So present moment, and then also internal state in that moment. How are you feeling? Do you feel relaxed? Do you feel stressed? Do you feel sexy? Do you feel hideous? You know, what's your mood? What's your relationship like? Are you in a good place? Are you struggling? Is there a communication breakdown? Has there been a breakdown in trust? Those are the internal factors that play a part of context. And so far, it seems like the evidence is pointing to the fact that women's sexual response is way more sensitive to context than men's is. And it varies from woman to woman, of course. If that's the case, if women's sexual response is highly dependent on context, we can't understand women's sexual well-being if we don't take context into account. And the thing is that a lot of context has nothing to do with sex itself. So let's talk about context a little more. Sensation. You even have context in sensation. So for example, touch. Imagine you are talking to and engaging with and flirting with someone that you think is attractive, and they, you know, you guys are joking around, being cutesy and all that, and they tickle you. Maybe you don't love tickling, but you like the connection that you have going on with this person. So it could be pleasurable. At the very least, it might not be as annoying as if you're in the club and a super annoying weasel-looking guy keeps following you around and asking you questions, and then he puts his disgusting, cold, slimy hands and long fingernails around your waist to tickle you. Is that cute? No, it's not cute. Like, I don't even know why you would think it was appropriate for you to talk to me. I'm clearly with my friends. I'm clearly not engaging you. Anyway, long story. But the point is, same sensation, not the same reaction. Your perception of the situation is totally different because the context is different. And this is true for all sensory domains. You could, let's take touch out of it. Let's go to smell. You know, if you're doing a smell test and you're blindfolded, so you're just focusing on your smell, your sense of smell. If you're told the item that you're smelling is cheese, okay, that's cheese. Great. But if you smell that same thing and you're told the item is underwear, you're going to have a different reaction to that. And, you know, I don't know how you feel about cheese personally. I don't actually like the smell of cheese, but, you know, I'm not going to have a stronger reaction to that smell if I think it's cheese. If that same smell is butt cheese, yeah, now I'm disgusted. The first one is just like, I don't like that. The second one is like, I'm throwing up in my mouth. And that's context. So what does that mean for us? I think that means we have to get to know what contexts work for us and which ones don't. There's another kind of like assessment or exercise in the book, which I recommend to do. As a matter of fact, let me just say, there's a whole separate workbook, like a companion workbook with this book that I highly recommend, because at the end of the day, having all of this information is great, but it's so context dependent that you really need to know, like, how does this apply to me and my life? So get the workbook. But back to my point, specifically about context, there is a kind of an exercise in the book where she has you describe some situations where the context wasn't great, some situations where the context was great, so you can kind of cherry pick and realize, like, what's working for me and what isn't. And if you don't, you know, do the workbook, I would at least recommend to go through the exercises that are in the book itself, because it does help you to get to know yourself. And that's really the key here. It's not just having the knowledge, it's applying the knowledge. So next, let's talk about liking, wanting, and learning. And we're still talking about the brain now. These are basically three mechanisms in the midbrain, or systems of our emotional brain. And the way that they can work independently or together, I think, is really key to know. So the liking system, it's basically the yes or no inside your brain. Your brain evaluates something and says, does this feel good? How good? Does this feel bad? How bad? And the system is also responsible for managing pleasure. It responds to sweet tastes. It responds to sexual sensations. It perceives beauty. It responds to winning. It responds to being in love. So that's liking. Then there's learning. Learning is the process of linking things together or associating things, linking like what happens now with what should come next. There's this popular experiment known as Pavlov's dogs. Basically, very basically, the dogs learn to associate the ringing of a bell with being fed. That's the learning system, making associations. So there's also the wanting system. And this is what fuels your desire to either move towards something or move away from it. And what's interesting is all these things can kind of play together or against one another. For example, you can like something without wanting more. Like, there is this diabolical chocolate cake at Costco. It is triple chocolate, chocolate cake, chocolate frosting, dark chocolate shavings on top. Oh my God, I love it, especially with ice cream and champagne. But anyway, after one piece, I'm over it for like a month. Like, I like it, but I don't necessarily want more of it after I have it. That's like liking versus wanting. And it works with the other systems as well. Like, your brain can learn a certain type of touch might lead to sex, but depending on the context, that may, you know, move you toward sex or it may move you away from sex. It just depends. All of these emotional mechanisms are context dependent. So many things in our sexuality are context dependent. So going back to that, that's like so key to understand about yourself and about your partner. So to wrap up this episode, we're going to talk about the stress response cycle. And this part obviously was so important that she decided to make a follow-up book, which is called Burnout. And at a very difficult time in my life, I came across that book and I read it. And I do think that it's something that's going to show up on the Stress in the City podcast, because she goes into a lot of depth in that book on how the stress cycle works and how to complete it. And I think that information is just life-changing. But going back to the stress response cycle and, you know, how it applies specifically to sex and intimacy, let's jump into that. So what's stress? Stress is a system of changes in your brain that gets activated in response to stressors. What is a stressor? Stressors are anything that activates the stress response cycle. It could be bills, family, you know, work, relationship issues, health issues, etc. So when your brain perceives a threat inside of your body, you experience a biochemical change and different physiological events occur. One of them is your hormones, adrenaline and cortisol, flood your bloodstream. Your heart rate may increase, your breathing changes, your blood pressure increases, your immune system gets suppressed, your digestive functioning gets suppressed, and other things as well. So basically, your body is preparing you to deal with a threat, preparing you to deal with the challenge ahead, like you're bracing yourself. It's kind of like, you know, let's say you're about to dive underwater. You brace your core, you take a deep breath, and your body kind of does that as well to deal with whatever it's perceiving as a threat. And the threat doesn't necessarily have to physically be right in front of you. It could be something that you're thinking about that your body creates that reaction to. And studies show that more than half of women report that stress, depression, anxiety decrease their interest in sex. It reduces their arousal. It interferes with orgasm. Chronic stress also interrupts the menstrual cycle. It can decrease fertility, lactation. It even increases miscarriage. And, you know, I'm so passionate about this because of things that have happened in my life because of stress. And I think, you know, we often tend to think about stress as this abstract, metaphysical thing. It's just like this thing that you can't describe, that you can't touch. But the reality is, it's actually very physical. Like a stressed body is biochemically different than one is that is not chronically stressed. And like, just think about that for a second. You can change the chemistry in your body by, let's say, like drinking alcohol or using drugs or being dehydrated. You do those things and you know, you have a chemical change in your body and those changes have impact. If you drink a lot of alcohol, what happens? You get drunk and you might make bad decisions. You don't drink enough water. What happens? You're going to have ashy hands and dry lips and a dry mouth. And if you go far enough with it, you straight up die. But in all seriousness, these things have chemical effects on our body, and so does stress. So what happens to your body when it's constantly pumping stress hormones? We're not supposed to be in a chemically stressed state 24/7. That's a recipe for burnout. Trust me, I know. I've made that recipe. So I want to get into that a little bit deeper when we go into the burnout book. Let me know if you're interested in hearing about that. You're going to hear about it anyway, but still let me know. So here's the stress cycle. Here's how it works. The brain acknowledges a threatened environment. That's step one. Step two, we choose how we respond to that threat. There are three responses that she describes in the book, but I'm learning more about a fourth response called fawn. But I don't know enough about it. I probably just summarize what I've understood about it. But starting with the ones in the book, fight. You know, that's you see a threat, you acknowledge a threat, you decide we about to throw hands. Flight is, you know, you see the threat, you're like, I don't think I'm going to win this battle, so I'm out. Freeze is, you know, yeah, I see that threat over there and I'm just going to like hide or play dead or do whatever and hope that they leave me alone. And then fawn, my understanding of it is the response to the threat is let me comply and do whatever is going to make this threat. And I don't know if this, I've only seen this in response to the threat being a person, but let me comply with whatever this person, this threat wants from me, and hopefully things will go well. So that's the stress cycle. And then it's like, then what? You know, so you see the threat, you respond, you choose your response to the threat, and then what do? This is what I think we really get wrong. We just go about our lives. We choose however we're going to handle the threat, and then we just go about our lives without fully clearing that accumulated stress from our nervous system. And I think so much so that, you know, some of us don't even really know what it feels like to not be stressed unless we're self-medicating or on vacation. And that's something that I've really had to learn is do not let stress build up in your body. And it feels it's self-soothing. That's a skill that I've really had to learn. Self-soothing is a skill that I've really had to learn and teach myself and be very vigilant about practicing. I do not let stress build up in my body anymore, even if I can't resolve the issue. If I'm stressed out about something, I'm taking a break. I'm going for a walk. I'm going to listen to music. I'm going to do something that's going to allow me to recalibrate my nervous system, even if I cannot solve the problem right then and there. And we have to do that. We have to do that because a lot of times we can't get rid of the stress. You know, we don't live stress-free lives, unfortunately. So we have to learn how to manage the stress and allow our nervous systems to become resilient. And that is how we do that. Other things that help complete the stress cycle, movement is the number one thing. But other things are sleep, affection, meditation, crying, screaming, making art, grooming. And I really, I totally get the grooming part because there have been so many times where I'm like, I'm having a bad day and I look like crap. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to take a shower. I'm going to do my hair. I'm going to put my face on. I'm going to listen to some Beyonce and get my life together. And it helps. It really does help. This is a skill. This is a skill. This is a skill that you can take with you outside of your sexual and intimate relationships, and you need to apply it to every aspect of your life. We need to be taught this. We need to teach our kids this, self-soothing. It's funny. Kids actually do this naturally. And then we, as we grow up, we are taught, like, we just need to take it. Like, you just need to get over it. But we don't get over it. We start self-soothing with wine. There's nothing wrong with wine. I like wine. But have other things in your arsenal. So that's a wrap on part one of my review of the book Calm As You Are by Emily Nagoski. Next episode, we will go into part two. And we'll be discussing attachment, cultural contexts, sex myths, and spontaneous versus responsive desire, which is a really big one. So make sure you tune in for that. So tell me what you think. What did you think about this episode? This is my second episode in life. So I'm interested to hear your feedback. Send me your stories. Send me book suggestions. You can reach out to me by email. My email is itsbrittanynicole@gmail.com. That's itsbrittanynicole@gmail.com. It's Brittany Nicole. My Instagram name is the same. It's Brittany Nicole. Let me know what you think or what you want to see on future episodes. I'm curious to hear from you guys. And while you're at it, go ahead and subscribe to the Stress in the City podcast. And if you're enjoying it, if it's adding any value to your life, or if it's simply entertaining, then leave a 5-star review. I'd really appreciate that. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.